The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, the latest on health and healing information, including what happens if you don't have enough vitamins, why exercising is important, and training your brain to be happy and living longer, that's possible. An apple a day does some really good things, and I'll tell you what all those are. Then, the latest on the stranglehold on Congress and the White House of the healthcare industry from Wendell Potter, and why the entire healthcare fiasco is just, it is a fraud. And Democrats and Republicans alike should reject this, and we should allow independents to come in and help guide the country in this moment. Because right now, we're being guided right off a cliff, and I'll deal with that. Also, climate change is driving the world towards a food crunch. I'll give you the latest on that. Martha Rosenberg, what drugs are in your Thanksgiving turkey? And that's it. My guest in the second part of our program today will be Professor Andrew Kolin. He is a professor of political science at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York. He specializes in civil liberties and constitutional law. We're going to talk about the state power and democracy. Earlier in the week, I interviewed Jesse Ventura, who gave us his point of view as a populist individual, former governor, and someone who's been spending a couple years now, about 4 years, researching things he never would have assumed would have had anything other than an official truth before, and now he finds that those are just official lies. So we have these police all across the United States who are beating up on just peacefully demonstrating individuals. How did we get to this place where the average American is not outraged by this and demanding those people engaged in this be held accountable? We'll talk with him on that issue, and I'll be inviting you to share your insights at the same time. Let's begin. Exercise helps us to eat a healthier diet. Now, this is from a Foundation for Science and Technology, and I'll quote this. It says, a healthy diet and right amounts of exercise are key players in treating and preventing obesity, and that most people are doing neither. And because they're not exercising the right amount, and they're not eating the right foods, and hence, then you end up becoming a leader in obesity. The fattest country in the world per population, the United States. Right behind it is Spain, an enormous amount of obesity. But I believe that there, even though they certainly are part of the Mediterranean, have the Mediterranean diet, they also have enormous stress. One of the highest official and unofficial unemployment levels, officially 20%, unofficially closer to 40%. So that causes people to do impulse eating. In helping people with dementia, which is when you start to lose your memory, it's important to have a vitamin blood chemistry profile done, also a hair analysis and heavy metal panel, also to see how much oxidative stress is going on in the body. All of these we can do today. There was a time when you couldn't, but we can get a pretty good profile, and that way we can help you rebalance. Almost without exception, by the time people in their 40s, they have advanced biochemical imbalance and degradation through oxidative stress, because nobody ever stopped to think what happens when you have that soft drink, or the hot dog, or the pizza, or the dessert, or the bagel. We assume because no one drops over dead after eating one of those, and it doesn't create a clinical, classical symptom immediately, that there's no problem. That overlooks the entire field of subclinical manifestation, meaning before you go broke, It's a process. You don't wake up one day and you have a bank full of money and the next day you're totally empty. The same way with health. It's cumulative. Until one day you tip. At the point where you tip, that's when you manifest the symptoms. This study shows that we end up having dementia and aging of the brain because of nutrient deficiencies. Quote, vitamin deficiencies could lead to more than just a musculoskeletal degeneration. A common concern with respect to such deficiencies is an illness called dementia. By the way, there was a time when dementia was called the old man's disease. It's a disease of forgetfulness where you simply lose your mental function slowly. Doesn't happen all at once. And the capacity to think and memorize things. Even though the usual associations with dementia are vascular problems and alcoholism and working with chemicals, a lot of artists end up with this. A lot of people with industry where they're making something, they're manufacturing something, they're breathing this in at close range. But now we're seeing that all it takes is just the normal American lifestyle to end up with dementia. So what do you need to help prevent this? First and foremost, just simply folate, B12, and vitamin D can make an enormous difference. Now, this is in the Journal of Neurology, Neurosurgery, and Psychiatry. And you wouldn't expect these to be talking about alternative therapies, but they have, and it's there. Most people don't get enough vitamin B12. It's very important for preventing dementia. I'm suggesting 1 milligram of methylated B12 per day. Vitamin D, very important for helping with our musculoskeletal system, helping with our bones, helping with our immune system. But also, according to the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease, Dr. Grant was doing research showing vitamin D can reduce the risk of dementia, which then leads to Alzheimer's, so you're reducing the risk of Alzheimer's. I'm suggesting 2,000 units a day. And then folate is very important. I'm also suggesting 1 milligram of methylated folate a day. Those are things we can do and we should be doing. Why is it some people are healthier and happier than others? Well, it could be due to training your brain to be happy and living longer. Scientific evidence now shows that you can boost up your mood by training your brain to do just that. People who are content, who have that sense of emotional and spiritual satiety where they feel full, they feel their life is complete, and therefore they feel happy during a day. They wake up with a sense of grace and dignity towards life, meaning they don't take it for granted. They don't wake up with an attitude. They don't wake up to blame someone for the failures in their life or what's not working. They wake up with this sense of contentedness. Now, the latest study shows that the people who are content are going to live a longer life and form healthier relationships and are less inclined to turn to crime. That's the latest study on this. And this is all based upon recent developments in neuroscience. And they found that the brain forms new neural connections in life. And when you're joyful and happy, that part of the brain structure is found to become active. And that's what registers happiness. Italian psychiatrist Dr. Giovanni Fava, in a study, encouraged his patients to keep a diary and record in it all their happy moments. And he found that once people wrote down details of positive moments and happy feelings, then that became what they focused on. Now, I'm very much supportive of this, and I think they really nailed this one. Because in our health support groups, the very first thing we work on, and we're right in the middle of a health support group as we speak, an anti-aging one, there's no nutritional protocol. It starts with, what is keeping you from enjoying the happiness you deserve in your life? And it's interesting because generally about 50% of the people will not come back after that first meeting. They think, oh, I thought I was going to come get a bunch of pills I'm going to take and then I'm going to live a longer life. And I say, well, there's no pill that's going to make you happy. The nutrients, the diet, the detoxification, all that's important and that will all come, but this is a puzzle. We're taking one piece at a time. And the very foundation upon which all happiness rests is this constitutional, primordial energy where you feel secure in who you are. So you're not questioning. You're not questioning your identity. You don't say, who am I? Whose life should I be living? Why aren't I feeling better? What should I be doing? When you're not wrestling with those issues, when there's a contentedness, and when you start looking then for appreciation in all things, you have two people. One will tell you why they're angry about what they don't have, and another will tell you why they're happy because of what they do have. Imagine how much time we spend being frustrated and then justifying the actions of our frustration. I'm frustrated because you didn't return my call, or you didn't do that, or you missed my birthday, you missed my holiday, you didn't remember our anniversary, and suddenly that clicks on all those old conditioned memory tapes of rejection, loss, and demeanment, that somehow because someone didn't do something you expected, they are demeaning you. When that could be the furthest thing from what someone has done, but then your whole mindset goes over to that area of looking at life from what you don't have. That then allows all these old conditioned negative thoughts to come up. I'm not worthy. That person's not a nice person. I'm going to be sad because I deserve to be sad. I'm going to be depressed because I deserve to be depressed. And then one tape clicks on to another, and the next thing you know it, you're not a happy camper. And guess what? You're going to live a shorter life. And you end up with diseases that are caused by the cascading of hormones, and they're predictable. So we can say, oh, it's someone's karma. That's nonsense. That's absolute nonsense. That's psychobabble. Everything in life is cause and effect, but it's cumulative. And if you think you could do something good and then something bad, something nice and something spiteful, something kind and something hateful, something selfless and something selfish, and somehow that all balances, it doesn't. So what happens is we live this dualistic life, and we're unhappy, and we're empty, and we try to fill this vacuous sense of incompleteness and loneliness with busyness and distraction. And depending upon our intellect and conditioning and determination, we will support ourselves in ways that give us a sense of meaning. But you want to see an awful lot of unhappy people? Come into some of the movements. And I'll show you why I never join movements, because even though I absolutely support the rightness of movements, I almost always have found the people who lead the movement to be seeking a life within the movement, instead of having a life and joining a movement and then keeping their life in balance. There is no balance. So when you see people who are zealots, when you see the true believers, when you see people who are finding their happiness in the relationship, man, do they have that wrong. You find your happiness, then you share your happiness within a relationship. Otherwise, every single thing that goes wrong in a relationship, you're going to blame on the other person, and therefore self-perpetuate your own misery. That's going to shorten your life, that's going to produce disease, and that's going to alienate you. So this study connected some of those dots. I'm glad to see they did. Eating too quickly leads to obesity. When you wolf down food, you can make yourself obese and slow down your day-to-day activities. And this is a new study on this, quote, eating too fast can contribute to general discomfort, indigestion, gulping down large amounts of food. You also gulp down the air, and that distends the belly, hence bloating. This was done at Nottingham University. So eat slow, take your time, put your fork and spoon down between bites, enjoy the food, taste it, and everything is going to be better. Remember, the nerves send signals to the brain that the stomach is expanding. At the same time, a hormone called ghrelin is produced, and when your stomach empties, it triggers a hunger message and takes about 20 minutes to inform the brain to stop eating. That means then when you're eating quickly, you're already completely full, but your brain is still telling you to eat. Whereas when you eat slowly, your brain says, you're full, no more appetite. So if you just ate slowly, you'd lose weight because of this. And finally, an apple a day keeps cholesterol away, and that's good. This is from the journal Experimental Biology, and I'll quote it. An apple a day really can keep the doctor away by reducing bad cholesterol levels, and apples are a miracle fruit that convey benefits beyond fiber content. That's according to the Margaret Sitton Professor and Chair of the Department of Nutrition and Food and Exercise Science at Florida State University. So, why? Well, because apples contain pectin and polyphenols, and that improves your lipid metabolism and lowers the production of pro-inflammatory molecules. So have yourself an apple, and you can help lower your cholesterol. Now, you can also juice the whole apple and get even more benefit. And that's why when I'm asking people to do juicing every day, at least with the green juices, it's cucumber, celery as your base juice, and an apple. And that's about 80% of the juice. Others can be more concentrated, whether it's watercress or broccoli or parsley. But that's apple is so important for you. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
There are so many kinds of riches, and only one of them is gold. The wealth you miss, remember this. Worthwhile things cannot be bought or sold. The moon belongs to everyone. The best things in life are free. The stars belong to everyone. They gleam there for you and me.
Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Noll. In about 20 minutes now, we'll be speaking with Professor Andrew Colin about state power versus democracy. I have been stating that I believe that we are now in a fascist state. I believe that the left and the right combined have refused to acknowledge the danger to our rights, to our constitutional rights, and our civil liberties because of the Patriot Act, the Emergency Powers Act, the Homeland Security Act, the 16 separate agencies, that $54 billion a year that these people are spending, and then it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. And now we are seeing police do things that they should not be doing, that we would expect from a fascist regime. Well, look in the mirror. Look in the dictionary under fascism, and you tell me how corporate elitists working as oligarchical power figures through their representative groups like ALEC and their lobbyists, of which there are over between official lobbyists of about 12,000 and then consultants of about 55,000 in Washington, and then they're working with legislators. How is that not fascism? It is. So at what point do we say, stop, enough? We haven't got there yet. We should. I'm going to deal with that when we come to him. A couple more things, and before we do, this is about the European Union. Now, we've been fighting Codex Alimentarius for a long time, and that's through the UN. And in Europe right now, they have banned 95% of all vitamins and minerals and herbs. And they did this because this is direct competition with the pharmaceutical approach. And they've been trying to do this in the United States. Henry Waxman is leading the charge to ban this. We are fighting back. I'm a signatory on a major lawsuit to sue the FDA. And I'm doing a documentary on the FDA to show the American public how corrupt this agency is and has always been. And we have some major articles coming out as well. The average person in Europe never knew that they would wake up one day and couldn't go out and buy ginkgo, or couldn't buy ginseng, or couldn't buy coenzyme Q10 because some so-called expert deemed that you didn't need it. Well, that's what happens. Here's the latest on what they're doing in Europe. The European Union bans claims that water can prevent dehydration. Brussels bureaucrats yesterday said that no one can claim that when you drink water, you prevent your body from dehydrating. I thought when I read this that there must be something else to this story. Then I read more deeply and found out that's exactly what they're saying. So complete is their control over what you can say about a product that you can't even say the whole reason for drinking water is to prevent dehydration. There's not a scientist, a physician, a nurse, a public health official in the world who would argue with that. The whole reason you drink water is to keep the water between 70 to 72% hydration of the cells. If you dehydrate, you can die. One of the leading reasons people in nursing homes died last year, thousands, because they didn't get enough water. But now they're saying, nope, can't say that. My God, as bad as the Europeans are at governing everything, this is just one example of how I didn't think you could outdo what they've done with Codex. Well, saying you cannot say water prevents dehydration. And that is really excessive. Now to the issue of turkeys. And this is from Martha Rosenberg from Alternate. I'll just quote some of this. So far, 2011 has not been a great year for turkey producers. In May, an article in Clinical Infectious Diseases reported that half of U.S. meat from major grocery chains, turkey, beef, chicken, and pork, harbors antibiotic-resistant staph germs, commonly called MRSA. And by the way, that kills tens of thousands. Turkey had twice as to three times the MRSA of all other meats. In June, Pfizer announced it was ending arsenic-containing chicken feed, which no one realized they were eating anyhow. Arsenic in chicken feed? Who knew? But its arsenic-containing histosat fed to turkeys continues. Poultry growers using inorganic arsenic, a recognized carcinogen, for, quote, growth promotion. And the FDA said that's fine. In August, Cargill Value Added Meats, the nation's third largest turkey processor, recalled 36 million pounds of ground turkey because of salmonella outbreak, death of an individual and 107 illnesses in 31 states. Even at its as it closed its Springdale, Arkansas plant, steam cleaned its machinery and added two additional antibacterial washes to its processing operations. 185,000 more pounds were recalled the next month from the same plant because of contamination. And since mad cow and Chinese melamine scandals in the mid-1900s, a lot more people think about the food they eat than before, but fewer people think about the drugs their food is imparted with. Food animal drugs seldom rate Capitol Hill hearings, and that's just exactly what the big pharma animal divisions want. No hearings. So you're getting antibiotics, heavy metals, growth-promoting mutant strains, vaccines, antiparasitic drugs, and feed additives all inside your turkey. And because antibiotics make animals use less feed, then they get fatter at less cost. It has nothing to do with the health of the animal. It has everything to do with profitability. And the FDA supports it completely. So just remember, when you go out to eat your turkey, you've got a lot of other things in that turkey that you didn't know about, that if they had a list of all the different chemicals that were in there, maybe you'd think twice. And the mother of all turkey drugs is the asthma-like drug that is called Topmax, T-O-P-M-A-X. It's approved for turkeys only 2 years ago, and it's used in most turkeys today. And it's also used in 30% of cattle and feed and pig feed. And there are two reasons this has raised some safety questions for those of us who are concerned. Read the label. The label of Topmax says, quote, warning, the active ingredient in Topmax is a hydrochloride. It is a beta androgenic agonist. Individuals with cardiovascular disease should exercise special caution to avoid exposure, not for use in humans. Keep out of reach of children. Not for use in humans. Well, who exactly is going to be eating the meat that this is in? Humans. Operators should wash thoroughly with soap and water after handling this. So, if accidental eye contact occurs, immediately rinse eyes thoroughly with water. If irrigation persists, seek medical attention. I see. Well, why didn't they tell us that? So we got antibiotics and arsenic and all this in your turkey. So keep that in mind. And then you understand why some of us are vegans. Let's go into our studio in New York City and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. Hi. This is a letter, it's a very long letter, an 8-page letter from a gentleman who's just retired after a long career in Hollywood as a personal assistant to some very famous screen legends. As a personal assistant, he'd arrange their business activities and take care of any issues in their homes, and he'd cook for them and arrange their special diets and so on. He writes about how once they were very famous and highly in demand, and then there would be nothing. The phone just wouldn't ring. And he imagined what it must be like for them to try to adapt to this when the agent finally says to them, there are no parts for you. Once, he said, he was hired by the studio to take care of the personal lives of the studio contract players, as the studio handled everything in those days, the stars' education, their vacations, hair, makeup. However, he could see that this only served to weaken them. Only a handful were able to segue from an active acting career to one where they had to do some, where they could do some kind of service or charity work. Otherwise, life had gone very quiet for them. He said they would spend the day watching TV and talking to friends all day. But he was reminded of a sad story this week when he heard that Regis had finally retired at the age of 80. He first heard of you when one of his famous friends had been helped by you with her arthritis. In under a month, it was all gone. And he watched you when you appeared on the Regis Philbin show in the 1970s. And there you were, this young man on the TV discussing how to help people with their health. He was instructed to get hold of you, so he called you in New York, and your brother Howard Null answered, and he was very, very nice and said you'd be happy to come out and see him when you're in LA in a month's time. A month later, he got a call from Howard Null to say, would you please pick up Gary from the studio and he'll come out and help you. What he remembers most is that he says that you were this young man with a refreshing sense of innocence, who was kind and naive, and you spent more than 3 hours speaking with this woman who was a screen legend. She was really taken with you, that you'd not charged any money, and you gave so much insight. Then you'd been taken back to the hotel, and the lady had said, I don't know if I can do all this stuff I meant to do, it's all too much. But when they spoke with you, you said, just do what you can. And in the end, she followed about 20% of the protocol, and this made a big difference to her. And she'd been a heavy smoker and a drinker. It took her a while to get off these, but her energy increased, and the respiratory problems vanished. And for the first time, she could sleep at night, which was very important for her. Over the next year, your name, however, circulated constantly because it seemed that you'd been counseling all these major celebrities in their 40s, 50s and 60s, and you had a real booster from counseling Gloria Swanson. He knew of this because he was close friends with one of the women who used to work for her. He wonders how many people know these older stars have lived a healthier and longer life as a result of your protocols. But otherwise, people would never have known any of this because you would never have betrayed a confidence of those you counseled. And it was all through word of mouth and a well-kept secret in Hollywood. He basically says that a whole generation is gone, but there are a few left in their 70s to 100 years of age. Only a few are alive. Long ago they've been forgotten to the public, but they're still living their lives, and he's still helping them with their investments and their personal matters. But he says it's bizarre to watch them as they're watching their old selves on the telly, and they're looking at a 20-year-old acting, that was them then, and now they're in their 80s, and he wonders what goes on in their minds when they're watching. So he calls you the kid who came to Hollywood and made it healthier. And his question is, do you still go out there, and do you still counsel people in Hollywood today?
No, I do not go to Hollywood and counsel the celebrities. I've counseled an awful lot of celebrities. I was very fortunate one of those unique things that happens in a person's life. There has to be a person I call a door opener, someone who invites you in, whether it's on radio or television or publishing. Almost all the good things that happen to any of the people are successful. If they pull back for a moment, they realize someone was there to facilitate them having access to the policymakers. I was on Regis show many times. I was a kid with a massive best-selling crossover book on health and nutrition. And there was no one else young in the field. I mean, everybody was in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, Adele Davis, Carlton Fredericks, all these people. And one day when I came out of doing this show with Regis on Good Morning Los Angeles, I think it was at the time, and I was doing it on a weekly basis, this gentleman was there, a short fella, bald, overweight, and he said, "I came down here after seeing you. I've seen you several times. My wife has a problem. We can't fix it. We've tried all the medical approaches. Could you help?" And I said, "Well, I'm on my way back to New York today." He said, "It won't take long. I don't live far." So I said, "All right." So I went up with this guy, and we went to his house, and I'd never seen a house like this. He had 40 bedrooms. It is a house that had been brought over from Italy at the beginning of the century. He was a very soft-spoken man. He was from Brooklyn. Jewish-born intellect who graduated from Princeton in social work, but he had been very successful at what he did aside from that, and he was doing a lot of work to help underprivileged people. So I counseled his wife and helped her, and she reversed her condition within about 2 months. And then his friends heard about that, and her friends heard about it, and then he was a major player in Hollywood. I'm talking about one of the guys who actually funds movies, one of the people you don't hear about, but boy, they're the people who greenlight projects. And it was just one person after another. What I found about these celebrities were, from that era, meaning the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, first, they were very decent people, very thoughtful and kind, and they were just regular people. So many of them reminded me of people I grew up with in West Virginia. But all of them were retired. And some retired very successful financially and some not. But they all had this sense of exuberance about life, but they also were very humble. And we would sit for hours and talk about health issues. And then if they improved, I'd get a call, "Oh, could you help this person, that person, this person, that person?" So I'd go out there, and then I used to go out on Sunday night, do my Monday morning television show, and fly back. Now I was going out on Friday morning and spending all day Friday, Saturday, and Sunday counseling these individuals, because one was always a friend of another. And that comment that he just made, this gentleman, about almost all of these individuals had a personal assistant. These were almost always older individuals who helped them with many of the things in life, if they could afford such a person. And when I'd ask them, "What do you do now? You retired from films 20 years ago." And one of them would say, "Like everybody else, each day I get up and I watch television and I hopefully have the phone ring. And you get invited, if they know you have any money, to benefits so you can write them a check." And this one person said, "It's very lonely, because once you've been a major star, it doesn't allow you to do anything else unless you're forced to, in which case one day people walk into a restaurant and you're the maitre d'. And that circulates real quick." And I said, "But why should you care?" And this is what this one very famous actress that everyone in this audience who's over 40 would know. She says, "Are you familiar with John Berryman?" I said, "Yes." And she says, "You must travel in the direction of your fear." And I said, "You're absolutely correct." And she said, "Most of the people who become successful spend half their time trying to have their next success and half their time in fear that they won't. So success is a poison. It eats you alive unless you're very mature and you don't take it personally and you realize that you're just going to be in this for a while. So get another career. have something you do behind this. And there was a sense of dignity in life that I met many of the men and women who were from the old Hollywood. But I would always get a nice little card, handwritten, thank you, Gary, for coming by and spending that time. And I'd send them, whatever I thought they would benefit from. And they kept in contact. The newer generation, completely different. Grossly insecure, extremely conceited, very arrogant, rarely wanting to come to see you without a group of people and retainers and posse, and almost never stick to a protocol because it interferes with what they want in life. And they don't seem to have this acceptance that there's an expiration date on everyone's career, on all successful things. And so they just live hard and they surround themselves with people who are enabling them. And then they start thinking they're more important than who they are. They're just human beings who happen to have been popular. And if they are coming from their spiritual side, they honor the fact that they have been given that gift, but they don't make their life their celebrity. Today, people become celebrities and don't want anyone to recognize they're a human being. So when we see people revert back to very primal, basic, and self-defeating habits, drinking and smoking and drugs and theft and many other things, we think, how could they do it? They have so much to live for. And you're thinking, okay, you're assuming that person recognized the quality of their life and the importance of their life prior to their success. Because if you become successful before you become successful at living as a human being, the success will eat you alive and destroy you. So no, I don't spend time counseling celebrities today.
Okay, that's okay. Great. Thank you.
All right, and anything else?
Yes, this is from a gentleman. His name is Roger. He has just returned after 9 months in Iraq. I'm sorry, he returned nine months ago from Iraq, where he says he and his friends, a lot of people that he knows, are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. But he's finding there are a lot of people in the community around him that also claim that they're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he doesn't understand why, because he can't see the stressful kinds of circumstances that they were under that could have caused it. He says, is this going to be the whole new catchphrase for people that are feeling stressed? Is everyone going to be using this term?
Yes. Because for those people who are just not able to deal with the normal stresses of life, the normal emergencies of life, they'll lump it under that and blame that versus those people who have had an actual traumatic event. And you have to look at the nature of the psychological trauma. There's a concept called psychological rupturing. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Okay. A psychological rupturing is something that is so devastating to our value system, to our principles, what we believed in, that it literally shatters all assumptions about the world in which we are existing. So it'd be much like the person who becomes a whistleblower because they have been around people who the public trusted with their money, like a Bernie Madoff or a bank, and then they see the truth that these people don't care about anyone, they're selfish in the extreme, and therefore they only want what's good for them. And then that kind of shatters the image of who this person they thought would be and the responsibility they have. It's like the President of the United States. Do you realize how shattering it is for people who gave not just a measure of their support to this president, thinking that this will be the change we all really need, and then saw that it was just more of the same and worse?
Right.
All right? This man should give back his Nobel Prizes. Was a Nobel Prize for war and aggression and imperialism, yes. Absolutely, he deserves it. For peace, when they didn't give Mahatma Gandhi a peace award, no. It dishonors what the real meaning of seeking peaceful solutions instead of simply continuing to be aggressive. So when you're seeing something, that can cause a rupturing of values. When you experience it, now look at a person in Iraq, in Afghanistan. You're walking down a road, and you know that their eyes on you. And from that apartment building down the street, from a ridge, from behind a tree, there could be someone sitting there on a cell phone waiting to detonate, and then you get blown up. How do you go from that environment where you must be extraordinarily disciplined, you must be on full alert constantly, back into your house at home when your kids come in and are yelling or want to do something? You haven't been deconditioned. Therefore, you overreact. Therefore, you're still in a battle, life and death mode. You demand things of your spouse. You demand things of your family that are unrealistic. They're acclimated. You're not. And we don't have a transition point. We should be building right now in every city in America outside the city, in public land. We should recreate the movable cities that we built in Afghanistan and elsewhere, where you have a barracks for women, barracks for men, barracks for families, psychological counseling, and an opportunity for them to be a transition point. Bring in the families. Allow people to realize now you're not in a war zone, because that's the only way that you're going to be able to re-enter society. Otherwise, you're going to end up seeing people absolutely destroyed. And that's what we're seeing. Look, today we're putting up on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and I think it's up right now. We're putting up there the latest film I just shot 2 weeks ago of 700 vets who came for one day to get free food and clothing and some counseling and medical attention to a stand down that was all volunteers in Titusville, Florida. Listen to what they're saying. What it's like to come back from a war zone and no one's there. Sean Hannity isn't there. Glenn Beck's not there. Nobody's there who wanted you to be considered our brave warriors when you went there. Now it's a dumping field. We need to do this for their sake and for our sake. Now imagine that you're experiencing trauma, but your trauma is an everyday 24/7 trauma. And you look as if the world is on your shoulders. And then what happens is a lot of people try to block out that, and they turn off the genetic switch, and then they turn to other things. And then over time, that creates memories and emotions that come back in at the inappropriate times, and then you suddenly start to recreate that whole trauma all over again. So you have avoidance and intrusion, avoidance and intrusion. How in the world can someone who's not been in that environment understand what real post-traumatic stress disorder is? Right. We need to find a way of helping people find happiness and meaning and purpose again in a non-conflict, non-stressed, non-threatening, and non-lethal environment. We owe every returning soldier and their family that. Now, on the other hand, we have a whole society that has sought its redemption through hedonistic pleasures. Day after day, night after night, weekend after weekend, channel surfing, twittering. And what does that ultimately lead to? Fulfillment? No. Happiness? Not at all. It's a form of distraction. And then we call ourselves, oh, post-traumatic stress. No, be very careful that that doesn't become a ubiquitous diagnosis. And otherwise, we have lost sight of those who really are affected, who need help, and we should be helping them.
Right.
Okay?
Thank you.
Good. Let's go to my guest who's standing by. I gave his background a little earlier, Professor Andrew Colin, Professor of Political Science at Hilbert College in Hamburg, New York, where he specializes in American political thought, civil liberties, and U.S. foreign policy and constitutional law. He is also the author of State Power and Democracy, Before and During the Presidency of George Bush. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for inviting me on your program.
I'm very concerned that from my personal perspective, America has been moving from an open society where we respected democratic principles, especially that of freedom of assembly, freedom of privacy, and freedom of speech, to a police state. With the Patriot Act, the Homeland Security Act, the 16 major intelligence agencies that are accountable to no one, the $54 billion minimally that was spent, and then how police are being militarized and how they're overreacting and how everything looks like they have to suit up for a SWAT raid when you're dealing with people who clearly do not represent a threat to anyone, except maybe the people in power who don't want them to exercise their freedom of speech and assembly. So would you please begin by laying down the conditions for which a nation can be accurately perceived as a police state? So
sure.
I'd like to have you go through it step by step. Because
sure.
Otherwise, and one last final thing, remember one of the reasons that that many countries rose up, the students and the older people rose up, was not because of the corruption in and of itself, or the poverty or lack of jobs in and of itself, or the exploitation of food by itself. It was because they had been living under emergency rule, and security always was trumpeting civil liberties, and there was absolutely no capacity for a person or a group to redress their personal rights being violated against state action and state-sanctified national security, where it concentrated the power of the government, particularly at the executive level. Could you address these also, please?
Sure. Yes, very much. These are all themes that have I've raised in my book. What I discussed was that over the course of U.S. history, there had been an ongoing conflict between the expansion of state power and the expression of mass democracy in the United States. So as you trace U.S. history throughout North America, what you see is that at this time, up until 1898, where we move overseas with the Spanish-American War, we see an ongoing effort on the part of the U.S. government to extend its control over people and territory, and in particular to go out of its way to prevent the expression of mass democratic progressive movements. And what we see as part of that, we see the government articulating, which is still the case in the present, what Stalin refers to as enemies of the state. We see this early on in 1798 with the passage of special measures, which we still have, certainly with the, in particular, the Patriot Act. We have the first of many. We have the Alien and Sedition Acts. And now if you fast forward, this trend continues with the passage of these pseudo-legal measures from the Espionage Act, the Sedition Acts of 1917-1918. We have in the 1950s the Internal Security Act. We have, again, various measures of a similar kind passed during the 1960s. Then as we move closer and closer to what I discuss in my book as a police state, we have the Clinton passage of the 1996 anti-terrorist bill, which is not discussed, which should be discussed because of its link to the Patriot Act. Now, as you mentioned in your introductory remarks, I characterize the United States as being a police state, and I define it in many ways, but briefly, I define a police state as a state within a state, a national security state. The president, and what I'm speaking of here is the executive branch, characterized by an ongoing state of national emergency, which unfortunately the United States has been in since 9/11. President Bush formally put in writing a state of national emergency on September 14th, 2001, which then carried over with the next administration of President Obama, who then declared on September 10th, 2009, he issued his continuation of a declaration of national emergency, Section 202D of the National Emergency Act, a proclamation 7463. Now, with such a ongoing state of national emergency, we have now other aspects of a police state appearing, most notably the absence of anyone accused of a terrorist of habeas corpus. So we see then that there is no longer due process in conjunction with the passage of the Patriot Act as long as you are being labeled terrorist. We have the ending of the attorney-client privilege with the passage of SAMS, the Special Administrative Measures. We have now the introduction of one of the hallmarks of a police state, preventive detention, where Guantanamo Bay Bagram and the CIA black sites. So now people are at the order of the president simply to be whisked off the street either inside the United States and elsewhere and disappeared and be subjected to torture, which is unfortunately all too common, another feature of a police state. That's some of the basic essentials.
Okay, good. That's a good overview. Now let's look at what is happening today. On the one hand, the Occupy movement will, I predict, exponentially increase probably 10 to 20 times more than what it is now. And with that, even though the vast majority are engaged in a healthy, dynamic speak out, if they're not going to have a on-point message, which I believe is one of the limitations of the movement, I've spoken with them about that, but even the fact that we have this many people showing up, speaking out, saying they're angry, this hasn't happened in a long time, and especially from a generation that hasn't done anything in a long time, or ever in most cases, there should not be at any point taking down names and photographing people who are peacefully demonstrating, arresting people en masse, using these techniques of batons and pepper sprays. This, to me, is completely police state, and yet the police state are protected, the unions protect them, and I think this is wrong. I believe that any officer that uses any undue force should be held accountable and themselves arrested, yet that's not going to happen. It seems, though, on one side of the equation, no one who's engaged in any torture has been held accountable, no one except for Abu Ghraib, and then it never went high up, as it should have, as we were told by a general it should have. No one has been held accountable for the wrongful death of Pat Tillman. No one's been held accountable for anything that goes wrong. And that is one of the signs also that you're in a police state where you can do anything you want with virtual impunity. Your thoughts on this idea that we're not holding anyone accountable
for
their actions?
Sure, I agree with most of what you're saying, but I would like to add that if you look at police states, and I would say this is applicable to the United States, over the course of time, because their oppression is so wide-ranging and it is so authoritarian, they tend to become dysfunctional. And the fact is that you have such broad numbers of people taking to the streets, and this is not just a national event, this is an international event, shows that, and look at even now, for instance, Egypt, that there is a pushback against such authoritarian policies, and there is hope in this. I would also add that it is no coincidence, as far as I'm concerned, that the occupiers, the movement as such in the United States began around Wall Street. So there is a overall message, in spite of what seems to be what the corporate media has says, unarticulated or unclear messages, that the issue is of corporate power, is of a capitalist economy in which profits remain and controlled in the hands of the few, and the rest of us have to fend for ourselves. And I think the authoritarian policies that have been in place and the violence employed is to basically try to keep these political elites in power.
Okay, but aren't we, as a person who's a professor in constitutional law, aren't we of the belief that the Constitution is designed to limit state power, and we have seen this whittled down through many different acts and bills to limit mass democracy and concentrate power in Washington and Wall Street, and this is most obvious during the Bush regime with the war on terror to keep the country in perpetual security alert and the Patriot Act. So address some of the more insidious policies enacted by the Bush White House and now being supported by the Obama White House that have contributed to the U.S. turning into a police state which raises governments above the rule of law, and gives some examples of how we are experiencing some of these policies. And finally, my last question to you today, shouldn't we be going back and holding everyone who got us into the war in Iraq and knew that the intelligence was faulty, shouldn't we hold them accountable for crimes against humanity?
Yes, I would agree, but I'd like to start with your very intriguing comment, which you said at the beginning, is that the Constitution is meaningless when the U.S. government has consistently appealed to issues of national security, and that is how they've been able to do an end run. By simply then saying that we are in a state of emergency and therefore the Constitution is unworkable. Now, as for the other particular aspects which tie the Bush and Obama administrations together, certainly what we see are some of the particulars that tie both these administrations in spite of Obama's nice sounding rhetoric at the time he was inaugurated. He has continued many of the Bush administration policies. For example, he has continued the support
just one quick second. For all of our stations that only carry part of the program, we're going to be saying goodbye to you now. But for those who would like to continue listening to the final answers from Professor Andrew Kolin, you can continue by going to progressiveradionetwork.com. Please continue.
Yes. What we see is a continuity of the authoritarian policies of the Bush administration now carrying over into the Obama administration. For example, we see the Obama administration supporting and was able to get the reauthorization of some of the most heinous aspects of the Patriot Act. There's been no prosecution of officials who tortured and committed war crimes. There's been aggressive persecution of whistleblowers, as we see what's been transpiring against WikiLeaks. We have the preventive detention of Bradley Manning. We see the continued expansion of executive power with Obama now even expanding the Bush use of signing statements. Guantanamo Bay has not been closed, and Obama continues with a network of detention facilities in Afghanistan, and in fact, Bagram has been enlarged. Practice of extraordinary rendition continues, but I find even most disturbing in terms of this particular aspect of the Obama administration that has gone way beyond the Bush administration is the sanctioning of extrajudicial executions. We see this with bin Laden and with the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, where now a president has appointed himself in the executive branch in overall as judge, jury, and executioner. We see also during the Obama administration the expansion of wireless spying. We see nationwide, and which is happening now with the Occupy movement, the FBI continuing its process of infiltration and raids on dissident groups. And also, speaking of wars, which is certainly part of this police state, the aspect of a permanent war, it was President Obama who escalated the war in Afghanistan. He also stepped up the covert operations of the CIA. He also extended the use of special operations. And in fact, during the Obama administration, there's been no less than 15 special ops during his administration. So, again, I do want to reiterate, in spite of what seems to be what I just characterized as a rather gloomy aspect, I do see the reemergence on such a somewhat of a grand scale of the Occupy movement as reason for hope. That one must keep in mind that sometimes the most oppressive regimes tend to be also the most vulnerable. That numbers are not in their favor, and they become dysfunctional as they are starting to be.
Okay. Well, I believe that before that becomes an issue, it has to be focused. You have to have spokespersons. You have to have research. You have to have information that can withstand pushback and that exceeds talking points. And then an actual action, like hold these people accountable. Close down the military bases, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan. Each and every one of these contributes to deconstructing the police state, none of which is being done. just masses of people showing up in public and resisting the pushback to get them out of that doesn't change anything. It merely shows that you have a movement of people who are angry. But then again, you could have a lot of different people in different movements who are angry about different things, and some who and many people are angry for the same reason. We're all angry at Congress. We know how selfish and dysfunctional they are. We're all angry at totalitarianism. We're angry when we see innocent people subjected to brutalities, but that doesn't mean it changes it. For that, you need lawsuits, you need investigations, you need whistleblowers, you need to show that someone did something knowing with malice aforethought that what they were doing was unethical and illegal and immoral and should be held accountable. That's the next stage this must evolve to. Otherwise, it's a lot of people protesting, but nothing fundamental coming from it. Final thoughts, please.
Sure. I agree all what you're saying, but if you look rather closely, there are already signs that these policies are having negative consequences for the United States, which in and of itself is going to, over a period of time, force some major changes in policy. For example, it is economically impossible for this empire to maintain itself, to maintain the economic course of maintaining over 1,000 military bases to wage permanent war. We see what is happening to the U.S. economy because of this endless war making, the economic course. And there have been empires in the past, if you look at England, that simply said, well, the economic course is too much. They've given up their empires, and they're all the better for it. And I say that's where perhaps one ray of hope is, outside of the protesters. It is the policies of the government itself are going to force certain kinds of change.
If I would agree with that, if we also have independent, progressive, spiritually aligned third-party people who will say, we can get out, we'll get out of all these interventions, we will stop all of the nonsense of supporting covert actions against the public, we will take back the rights that the president hasn't given them back, we will take away the Patriot Act, take away Homeland Security Act, reestablish habeas corpus. The only way that will happen ever is when you have the people coming forward, like a Chris Hedges or Jesse Ventura or Michael Lerner or any one of thousands of progressive minds, not Democrats, because even people over at The Nation magazine, even people, if they're at The Nation and they're on the Council on Foreign Relations, then they already have a card-carrying position. They're not going to change that. They're not going to say we have to get out of all these places. Let's just kind of modify this. We need people who are going to make radical choices, stop something forever. By the way, in 1946, that happened in England. That's one of the reasons after Second World War that England stopped its imperial design and had to completely scale back. It wasn't because the Tories or the Labour Party suddenly stood up one day and decided they wanted to be more benevolent towards the world. They were forced into doing that. And they were broke. They were absolutely bankrupt. I believe that we need to focus our attention on new faces, new voices, and bypass the Democrats and Republicans. Vote for none of them.
Sure, but just as England was forced to make some radical changes, my sense of the current policies of the United States may force some similar changes. Now, as for the leadership and people in a movement, which I find rather refreshing, and you see all the different alliances that a part of this movement is, they're starting to raise an issue which I feel is of utmost importance if we're to have some kind of basic democracy in the United States, and that they're calling for economic democracy. And if there's going to be fundamental change, if there's going to be a change in taking money out of politics, we first need democracy to appear in the workplace. We really need economic democracy.
The trouble is you're absolutely correct, but we don't control democracy in the workplace today. The Koch brothers on one side and George Soros on the other side, the people with allied groups, they control the laws at the state and federal level, which dictate the hourly wage. You want to turn America around tomorrow? Then how about sharing 20% of all pre-tax profits instead of giving it to your shareholders, instead of bragging to Wall Street that they can continue to give you super cheers? Why not give that to an increase to a living wage to your workers, if we gave back a living wage so every American working was working at a living wage, we would be able to turn this economy around within 12 to 24 months. They're not willing to do that. And hence, I don't see until such time that people withdraw from the economic matrix they're part of and start supporting made in USA, made by independent labor, made by people who are ecologically conscious. Don't buy anything from these companies. Don't put your money in their banks and don't vote for them. Don't watch their television. Don't watch their listen to their radio. We have to, as hard as it is, we are like opium addicts in 1890, trying to give up the opium and deal with the facts of life. And we haven't done that yet. And I'll finish with this. Was it not the great George Santayana who said, every real object must cease to be what it seemed, and none could ever be but the whole soul desired? In other words, we need to face the reality of our lives. And it was Arthur Koestler who said, nothing is more sad than the death of an illusion. American democracy, as we're practicing it, is an illusion. Capitalism, which is vulture capitalism, instead of more humane capitalism, is an illusion. The benevolence of our impact around the world is an illusion. The idea that we're going into countries to promote democracy and peace and freedom is an illusion. The fact that 99% of Americans are victims and 1% are the vultures is an illusion. I could show you an awful lot of people in that 99% who contribute to their obesity, contribute to their demise, and are selfish. If they had the means that the 1% do, then that 1% would go to about 40%. So we have made an oversimplification on who's on the side of angels in history and who are not. Thank you very much for coming on and sharing your points of view. I really respect your insights.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Professor Andrew Colin, my guest. The book is State, Power, and Democracy. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Come and meet those dancing feet. On the avenue I'm taking you to. Street. Hear the beat of dancing feet. It's the song I love, the melody of 42nd Street.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tavenfeld.